entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
It sure is, and a good Sunday morning to you. Welcome into the best of Downtown on this 11th day of the month of August. Rich Kimble, Carrie Haskell here with you. Brought to you, as always, by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. It's our weekly look back at some favorite recent conversations, and we've got three good ones for you this morning. Friend of the show, actor John O'Hurley. Bangor native, archaeologist and author Sarah Parkak. And new friend of the show, John Davidson, will check in with us as well on this Sunday morning. Let's get things underway. We had a milestone celebration the other day, our 2000th downtown show, and we reached out to some of our best friends and frequent guests. Few people in the celebrity realm have been on the program more than actor John O'Hurley, Jay Peterman from Seinfeld, who came back to help us celebrate show number 2000. We appreciate you coming on to help us celebrate a big round-numbered show.
My pleasure.
What's been going on? How's your summer been so far? I see you were, I watched a wonderful rendition of the national anthem down at the Charlotte Knights game.
Oh, that was kind of impromptu. It was a three hour rain delay in the anthem when they finally got going at 9:45. The person who was scheduled to sing the anthem had already bolted.
Oh.
So the owner of the team turned to me and goes, "You mind doing the anthem?" I said, "Let's do it." So it was rather impromptu.
No, I got very excited. I saw your tweet that you were going to be there, and there were bobbleheads, and I was hoping they were John O'Hurley bobbleheads.
They are. They were Jay Peterman bobbleheads. They are the JFK Golf Club bobbleheads.
Wow. Now, I need to get my hands on one of those.
we'll have to get a pair on your one of your hands there, yes.
You've also got the third season coming up, actually, over the weekend, episode one of The Lion Guard. What a wonderful show, and what a stellar cast you're a part of there.
You know, it is a fun show. That one caught me by surprise. I did one episode, and they had so much fun with it that they called me back for a bunch more. So the character is kind of hanging in there. And then also the other show that I really like, Phineas and Ferb, I've heard, through a little birdie has told me that I just recorded the movie for it, and I heard that ABC is bringing that back. Disney's going to bring back Phineas and Ferb, which would be fun. I think it's one of the great series ever done.
Oh, I would love that. Around my house with my five-year-old son, we are big fans. We can't get enough of Roger Doofenshmirtz.
And his evil brother.
Yes, indeed, yes. Although, you know, clearly, the right one is the mayor of that community.
Yes, he's the least interested.
It's great too. I was watching premium cable the other night, and I looked up, and there was Swing Away, and I got a chance to watch it a second time. Well, what a wonderful film that is!
Oh, it really is. It's a wonderful little charmer that we shot in Greece. It really is. We didn't shoot it for very much money, but everything was on the film. It was just a beautiful experience, and so many wonderful, happy accidents, you know, happened to make that movie happen. I have another one coming up very soon called Walk to Vegas with the Van Patten brothers, if you remember them.
I sure do. The World Poker Tour.
It is an absolutely delightful film, I think. And Roger Roper just gave it a huge thumbs up and really, really enjoyed it. It's out on, I believe it's out for pre-buy now. And you can buy the show, but you can actually buy the movie before it's out in the theaters.
Excellent. We'll look forward to that. We're talking with John O'Hurley here on Downtown. Tough weekend for our Red Sox. I don't know. There's still some time left in this season, but it's always rough to follow a World Series championship.
Well, it is, and they just don't seem to have one side is strong, the other side isn't. You know, and they haven't been able to depend on their starting pitchers. Sadly, this year, I mean, they have such talent, but they seem to be finding a way around them. But I always believe, you know, there's a lot of baseball left, and, they can, you know, this is the team that's capable of going on a 10-game win streak. So All things, you know, no bets are off. Wild card still in contention.
Have you had a chance to get up and play much golf this summer?
Not too much. I did play up in Tahoe. Been a very busy summer. Actually, the family has moved. We moved within the L.A. area, but that involved selling the house in Beverly Hills and packing up and moving out towards the city of Westlake Village, where my son is going to be going to school. So it's been a big upheaval this summer.
Have you had a chance to get back to New England at all?
Well, we did have we had our wonderful time in Vermont, which we do every year for about 4 or 5 weeks, and a lot of fishing. Turned out to be a great, great time, and great weather this year as well.
You posted something recently about some additional work that you'll be doing with SUDEP, sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. I know what an important cause this is for you. What are some of the things you'll be doing to raise awareness and raise money?
Well, you know, I lost my sister to epilepsy back when I was 16 years old, and she was 17. It's a syndrome within epilepsy, and it's called sudden unexplained death. And you termed it exactly right. SUDEP is the acronym for it. But the problem is they don't know any way. They don't know why it's caused. It's absolutely a mystery. So several years back, the Epilepsy Foundation of America put out a challenge to the researchers, and it was called the Biomarker Challenge for SUDEP. And basically what they're trying to do is establish the biomarker, the database that is common to all cases so that they can go back and start to begin to attack this, you know, one step at a time. They have so I'm raising funds now for this biomarker challenge, and they're at the goal line. They've had hundreds and hundreds of applications over the last several years. They have 25 that are down into the proof of concept stage, and they now have three projects that they say they term them as home runs. So I'm busy raising the money necessary to get those over the goal line. And I'm going to take the next 2 years to do that.
Well, that's wonderful work. We wish you well with that. By the way, we've asked listeners to vote on. Out of our 2,000 shows, our greatest moment in show history. And one of the five finalists is you doing a lost J. Peterman monologue a few years back. And boy, it's getting a lot of votes. That may end up as the greatest moment in our show's history.
Well, that would be quite an honor. I hope some sort of trophy goes with that. I'll put that on the mantle. That's wonderful.
Huge trophy, no question about that. John, we just want to thank you for your wonderful support and willingness to come on with us through the years. It's much appreciated. We're big fans of everything you do. Thanks so much for coming on today, and I'm sure we'll check in with you again in November.
I'm a big fan of yours too, Rich. You're a great interviewer and a wonderful host.
It's John O'Hurley joining us the other day for show number 2000 here on Downtown. And as we talked about with John, we've been asking for your input, listener input, to help us choose, we say the best, the greatest moment in the last 2000 shows. There is no overall great, but we had some pretty good final candidates. And the one that was chosen, well, certainly was one of our favorites as well. From a couple of years back, Bryan Cranston in his second appearance on the show, playing a little Bryan Cranston trivia.
Time for another one of Downtown's greatest hits.
Well, Bryan, it's your second time on the show, so you feel like an old friend to us. Now, I wonder if you'd be willing to play a little game with us.
Okay.
You've created so many iconic roles through the years with Walter White, with Hal from Malcolm in the Middle, Dr. Tim Whatley and Seinfeld, but people may not know you had a long, long career before those shows made you a huge success. And I wonder if we could throw out some characters and see if you could recall what show they were on.
Wow. You might just stump me. I would be surprised if I remembered.
All right, let's start with this one, because actually you talked about this show the last time you were on with us. Your character was Douglas Donovan.
Now, that show I know because I played that character for 2 years on a daytime drama, a soap opera called Loving, back in the early 80s. With our friend John O'Hurley, yeah. He was my nemesis on the show. In fact, we married the same woman. One of your typical, at the same time, we were married to the same woman at the same time. And, of course, I didn't know it. Because good guys don't know it.
Right.
Bad guys know it. So, yeah.
All right, you're one for one. How about this one? Uncle Russell.
Okay. Uncle Russell was a character I played on a show for CBS called Raising Miranda, a beautiful show that I think was before its time. It was really sweet and funny, but it wasn't like a laugh riot. And I don't think the network really knew what to do with it at that time. But I enjoyed it.
You're on a roll here, two for two. How about Lieutenant Gordon Denton?
Lieutenant Gordon Denton. I guess he's a cop, or he could be in military, right?
Yeah, I would go with Gordon your first Denton. Instinct. I would go with cop.
A cop. Lieutenant Gordon Denton. I don't remember. What was that one?
That was Brooklyn South.
Oh, boy, that was a story. I put that in the book, too. That was one of my worst experiences as an actor. No wonder I blocked that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Now, you've played a lot of doctors through the years. This was just a one-time appearance as Dr. Harding Fletcher.
Dr. Harding Fletcher. Probably on something like Murder, She Wrote.
Ooh, you're so close. You're right in the neighborhood with another TV icon.
I'll say maybe Matlock.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. There you go. All right, and the last one, early.
You know, Rich, you got to have a bell.
I know. We should have a bell.
Ding, ding, it's winning. Yeah.
Okay. Or thunderous applause. Here's the last one. Do you remember playing Robert Hollis?
Robert Hollis.
Working with an Academy Award winner.
Was Robert Hollis my character on a show called Airwolf?
Yes. Wow. That's impressive. Now four out of five with about 150 IMD listings. Well done, sir.
Wow. Well, that was a very important show for me to do because I met my future wife on that show.
Well, there you go.
That was like 31 years ago or so. 31, 32 years. Wow.
Well, that's incredible.
Time flies.
Voted the greatest moment in the last 2000 Downtown programs, Bryan Cranston playing a little Cranston trivia here on Downtown Z62. We'll take a break and come back with author, archaeologist, and Bangor native Sarah Parkak next on Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference with a limited warranty that's three times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Summertime is best spent chillaxing, and chillaxing happens best with the flavors of summer at the Ground Round. Right now at the Ground Round in Bangor, savor the summer grilled chicken sandwich. It's a tender chicken breast topped with pepper jack cheese and a citrus garlic fruit salsa on a grilled split top bun served with the Ground Round's house-made pasta. Wash it down with a sangria and round out the meal with the perfect dessert, the strawberry float cake. Seriously, it's amazing. Take your summer chillax to the max with the Ground Round on Audlin Road in Bangor. GroundRound.com.
Hey, we're back on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell here.
Sometimes when this place gets kind of empty, sound of the breath fades with the light.
Our next guest on the program is an archaeologist, a professor at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, a Bangor native, TED Talk Million Dollar Award winner, and the author of a wonderful new book entitled Archaeology from Space. Sarah Parkak, next on Downtown. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I kind of have to because your parents live right around the corner.
Uh-oh, did my dad pay $20 for this?
It was actually $25.
Oh, all right, all right. That's good. That's good to know.
Worth every penny. The book is absolutely wonderful, and I do want to talk about that, but I want it to be clear right away. A, I read the book, and B, unlike those people in Australia, I know you're not going into space doing archaeology.
Oh, yeah. I believe you're referring to the section where I got some insurance rates that were off the charts. People actually thought that I was going to space to look for sites versus finding them on the ground.
It's fascinating to read about the technology. Can you give an overview that the average layman and listener to our show would understand?
Sure. So think of the traditional work that archaeologists do, right? We're going out, we're mapping, we're surveying, we're excavating. And what the satellite imagery allows us to do is think of like almost like a space-based CAT scan, where we're using kind of like a high-tech Google Earth, and we're looking for subtle differences in vegetation or soil that we can't see with our naked eye, and we're processing the information using pretty standard software. And then these features pop up that look like potential settlements or tombs and sometimes even pyramids. And once we get that information, then we go out on the ground and we either excavate it or map it.
I was stunned to see the cost of using some of these satellite images. Now, it's getting better as technology improves, but this is not for the faint of heart.
Right. I mean, it depends on how much information you want. You know, of course, we archaeologists at state universities prefer free. So we use a lot of NASA imagery. There are millions of images online that are totally free. And the cost has come down a lot. You know, when I started this work about 15, 20 years ago, a single satellite image could cost many thousands of dollars. Now to get a single image of an archaeological site, it's a few hundred dollars. Again, it's not free, but it's definitely, much more possible for grad students and beginning professors to use the information.
Is it accurate to say that this doesn't replace what we think of as standard archaeology? It's another tool, it's another step in the process, because once you have these images and you have what you think is there, you still have to get down and do some digging.
That's right. You know, at the end of the day, what this is a targeting mechanism, or it allows you to map sites or features in areas that are either too inaccessible or too dangerous to visit parts of the world where there's conflict going on. And so once you have that image or feature or site, you then have to go out on the ground and either dig it up or survey it. And frankly, that's the most fun part.
And the technology, as you point out in the book, is not foolproof. And you share a very interesting story about what happened when you were looking for Norse artifacts in Newfoundland.
That's right. You know, many people, of course, for the last 50 plus years have been looking for new potential Viking sites all along the East Coast up into Canada. And no one had ever before done a proper scientific search, kind of letting the data drive what they find. And so we did this. We looked along the entirety of the coastline of eastern Canada. We found a potential site after a lot of analysis and research. We went out to do excavation. And what appeared to be, a very clear example of potential architecture, some of those features turned out to be natural. Now, one of the features we found does have multiple sort of radiocarbon and other dates that does suggest it's human and there could have been a burning activity. That it still could potentially be Norse, but at the end of the day, you've got to let the science speak for itself.
What I was impressed about is that the people there were still very pleased with it went and gave you credit for raising the bar for future archaeological work there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I believe fully in academic honesty. I have to be, otherwise I'm in big trouble for the work I do. And, it's ultimately about pushing the boundaries of science. And that particular case is what I call kind of more high-risk archaeology, where you're not 100% sure. You're working in an area where no remains like it have been found before. But I think we now have a pretty good methodology for the future survey and mapping of other potential Norse sites in the region. And we certainly know from the Viking sagas that there are other sites out there.
Your husband, Greg, is also an archaeologist and Egyptologist, and you write a wonderful chapter about Tanis, which all of us fans of Raiders of the Lost Ark are drawn to. And to me, that was a really wonderful story. I had no idea about the depth of what is there.
It's amazing. It was was Egypt's capital for hundreds of years. It was a massive city. There would have been tens of thousands of people that lived there. We're talking everyone from kings and queens and princes out the stables for the king. This would have been a really active, thriving city in the heartland of Egypt for both religious purposes and administrative and political purposes. So it's pretty shocking to think that this huge site had never before been fully mapped, and then with the satellite imagery, we're able to very clearly see the outline of the heart of the city.
We're talking with Sarah Parkak on Downtown. Her book is Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. And you talk about this in the book, that often we focus on things, artifacts like jewelry, and things that were important many times to the wealthy and the rulers, but that's not the real story. And when you're trying to learn about how people lived, sometimes it's better to get away from those things and look at homes, look at the way cities were laid out.
That's right. You know, when you think about, you know, your daily life or anyone's daily life, you know, does a ring or a piece of jewelry talk about who you are? Or look at the plates that are in your kitchen or the furniture that you have. It's more the objects that you today use every day that kind of give a sense of your identity. And it certainly would have been that way in antiquity. We're much more interested, and we get much more information about broken potsherds, because that tells us, you know, what activities were taking place, what was being cooked. By looking at the make of the pottery, we can tell the class of the people. Were they rich? Were they middle class? Were they poor? And we're able to infer so much information about trade. So, yes, these objects of daily life and sort of the houses and the settlements and the outlines of what was there that just, to me, tell us so much more about past people.
The book is such a wonderful read, and as I've said to people, it's a very funny book as well. You got a great sense of humor, obviously. Did you have to balance the science and remind yourself, okay, this is not an academic journal, but is it true that you also had to say, okay, maybe I need to cut back on some of what you've referred to as dad jokes?
Yeah. For those in Bangor that know my dad, JP, everyone knows he likes to tell a joke or two, and that's certainly the household I grew up in. I love telling jokes. I tell them probably way too often in my classes. And I had this wonderful editor at Holt named Michael Signorelli. And at one point, you know, he said to me, look, Sarah, you're not a humor writer or a comedian, you know, trying to write a science book. You're a serious scientist who's goofy. There's a big difference. You need to remember that light touches to kind of pull people along. But it got to the point where, like, I'd have one too many wisecracks and he would just cross it out and write no. So there are a couple of good ones that I pushed for and I was able to keep in, and there are a couple of good ones that didn't quite make the cut, but it's okay. You know, he was right. There's a balance. I'm sadly not a writer for Comedy Central, although if they're listening, I'm certainly available for hire. So yeah, it's important, but also I think it kind of keeps the book real. The idea of connecting the past and the present with humor, I think helps to make people more open to reading about history and science. So it's something I definitely tried to balance out.
Well, it worked. The balance is wonderful in this. You talk about the influences on your life and your career in the book. One of them is your grandfather. Can you talk a little bit about him?
So my grandfather, his name was Harold Young. He was a professor of forestry at the University of Maine until his retirement, and then he worked for years as an engineer at the Sewell Company in Orono. So, you know, but for me, obviously, he's my grandfather, and I didn't quite understand that he was one of the pioneers in the application of aerial photography to forestry, and he kind of picked this up during his service in World War II as a captain in the 101st Screaming Eagles. The paratroopers would get little fold-out black and white maps to tuck into their uniforms, because he and his troop colleagues would need it to sort of gather themselves and meet at fixed points. And so he took this technology with him to forestry graduate school, and would use the technology to kind of map and measure tree heights and look for particular tree species. And to us, we take this for granted because, like, we all have Google Earth on our phones. But in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, this was really, really cutting-edge stuff. So the reason I took my first remote sensing class as an undergraduate is because of him. And I thought, well, I bet a lot of people have used this for archaeology and especially Egyptology, but the reality is not a lot of people had.
I'm a high school teacher when I'm not here on the radio, so I have to ask, growing up in Bangor, were there some teachers that inspired you as well?
Boy, you know, I brag to everyone still about the quality of the Bangor public school system. You know, Bangor kids have gone all over the world and done some pretty amazing things. And it's because of the teachers. You know, I think of my fifth grade teacher, Jeannie Butterfield, who remains to this day one of the best teachers I've ever had in high school. I took ancient history with Mrs. Searway. Of course, Jim Smith in the history department was always extraordinary. I think of course, where I learned how to write, and I think of, so many extraordinary teachers in the Bangor High School English department, Mrs. Jones being one of them in freshman honors English. Bill Ames, of course, was amazing. I could keep going and going, but there were many, many teachers who made a big impression on me, and not just for writing and learning, but also for how to be an effective teacher and how to show compassion and empathy for your students. That certainly held over very well for a lot of the college classes and college kids I teach.
You also had a chance, and you tell the story in the book, to meet the most famous fictional archaeologist in the world, Harrison Ford.
That's right. Yeah. So this is at TED a couple of years ago, and he happened to come that year, the year that I gave my big TED talk, and some of the folks there very kindly arranged a lunch between myself and Harrison and my husband and a few other people. He was so kind and so generous to meet with me and to talk with me. His real passion is animal conservation. But he was definitely bemused when he met me, and I was so lovely to be able to thank him because, yes, of course, he's a fictional character. You know, as he told me, you probably know more of the movie lines than I do, but the reality is he ended up inspiring hundreds, if not thousands, of archaeologists of my generation, a little bit behind and in front of me, to enter the field with that movie. So it was really lovely to be able to thank him for that.
And you brought out the hat as well.
Oh, yes, yes. There's a photo of us arguing over the hat, and sadly that is one I can never share publicly. But when I pulled it out, he's like, I can't believe you brought the hat. And he looks and he goes, only you would ever get away with this. I would never let anyone else pose with me with this hat. So I think he was definitely indulgent with me.
The TED Talk also led to an appearance on Late Night with Stephen Colbert. What was that experience like for you?
It was wild. I mean, you know, you don't know what's going to lead to what. And when I got the notification, I sort of had to rub my eyes and go, really? The Stephen Colbert, The Late Show? And it was actually the first live taping of The Late Show, so no pressure. And I remember just before I went on, one of the producers pulled me aside and said, look, okay, I know you're nervous. Some bits of advice for you. First of all, academics. You talk way too long, short, quick, pithy answers. Secondly, Stephen is the funny one, not you. Let him drive the conversation, and it will go really, really well. And I listened to her. We had a blast. There was one moment, though, I didn't know whether or not he'd bring out some of the satellite images I'd sent to his team, and he did, and they were upside down. And so I flipped over one once, and he and the audience laughed. And I thought, I'm not going to get lucky again. And the second image he brought out was also upside down. So, of course, me being my father's daughter, I waited a second and then flipped it over. The audience lost it. He looked at me. He's like, you were having way too much fun, which, of course, I was. It was amazing. But I don't know if I could do that again.
I have to ask you this. I noticed in the acknowledgments, and I'm a big fan of both of them, you talked about Bella Fleck and Abigail Washburn. What's the connection there?
So Abby and Bella are good friends. Abby was in my TED Fellows class in 2012. So they are just the kindest and most generous, wonderful human beings. I've gotten to meet some really, really amazing people in my work and in my job. I feel very, very blessed in that respect.
So what's the future of space archaeology? Where can you go from here as access and technology improves?
I think as things develop, we're going to see a lot more work with drones. Obviously, satellites, you can use them to map, you know, much larger areas. Drones, you can use them to focus on a specific site. But I think we're going to see a lot more sensors and tools attached to drones for faster and more accurate mapping. I think the satellite technology is only going to get better over time. Right now, the highest resolution imagery to which we mere mortals have access is a resolution of about 11 inches, so think roughly the size of an iPad. But that resolution is going to improve over the next decade or so. And I think the cost will continue to come down. I think more and more will be cheaper and cheaper and cheaper for us to access. So, yeah, I think, as you know, I have a chapter in the book where I talk about what archaeology is going to be like in 100 years. And we're at that time, we're moving to more autonomous drones and dig bots. But I think we're starting to see some of these technologies employed now.
And why is it important for us to continue to look to the past for answers that can help us prepare for the future?
Well, I think, you know, regardless of which side of the political aisle you're on or whether you've totally left any political aisle, I think we can all agree that, you know, we're dealing with a lot of challenges right now in our world. Of course, from climate change, we're facing enormous threats as the Arctic is on fire and Greenland is melting at rates that we thought we wouldn't see for another 50 years. Obviously, enormous political conflict, tension, the rise of white nationalism, hate crimes. It's pretty tough right now to feel any hope for the future. And I think what studying archaeology does, at least for me and for my colleagues, it shows us this tremendous diversity of perspectives and cultures and religions and languages and peoples. And ultimately, everyone living on the planet today is a distillation of this great diversity of ideas. And the idea that diversity should be celebrated because it's what makes up our modern identities. I think by studying the past, by learning about other cultures, it opens us up, it makes us more empathetic. Certainly when you're standing in front of the Great Pyramids of Giza, I don't care who you are or what your beliefs are, you're going to feel awe. And if you don't feel awe standing in front of the pyramids, there's nothing I can do for you. You're officially dead inside. But to feel awe means feel small, and to feel small is not to feel bad. It means you are open to the possibility of the extraordinary achievements of other people, and you realize you're just one person in a sea of billions. So that's what I think archaeology can do, because when you feel awe, you're open to feeling empathy, and when you feel empathy, you can connect to other people, and if you can do that, maybe you'll be a little bit nicer to them, and maybe you'll start to recognize that diversity is important and that these past peoples had so many different ideas for how to deal with things like climate change, and that there's a little bit of hope moving forward.
Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past is the title of the book. It's a wonderful read, by the way. Also a great follow on Twitter at Indy from Space. Sarah Parkak, love the book. What a delight to talk with you this afternoon. Thank you so much for making time for us.
I'll always have time for my Bangor folks. Thank you so much.
That's author and Bangor native Sarah Parkak talking about her terrific book, Archaeology from Space. When we come back, entertainer John Davidson joins us. It's Downtown on Z62.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Downtown is brought to you every day by Bangor Mall Cinema 10, 557 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Presenting the best in new releases with completely renovated theaters and stadium seating, Bangor Mall Cinemas is the best place around to see your favorite films. Don't forget Golden Ticket Tuesdays, where everyone 62 and older can get it for just $7 for regular features. With Dolby Surround Sound, a digital surround, easy access from I-95, and the most comfortable theater experience around, visit Bangor Mall Cinema 10, 557 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, where they have a film for everyone in the family.
Hey, good looking, what you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
Well, you know our next guest from television, Hollywood Squares, his own talk show, motion pictures, the Broadway stage, appearances all over the country. And his music, although, as he said, he recorded a dozen albums or so, but has never had a hit. But a great friend of downtown, John Davidson, who rejoined us to talk about, well, an interesting and challenging summer and some exciting things ahead. You've had an interesting summer. Can you want to talk about what happened to you?
Oh, well, I sure have. I've been doing shows now all over New England. I'm going to Texas this summer, and I'm playing Birdland. Remember the old Birdland Club in New York City?
Well, yeah, you sold it out a couple of months ago, and you're going back, right?
Yeah, they invited me back. I'm a little scared because I sold it out because I called all my friends who were in Broadway shows with me. You know, I played The Wizard in Wicked, and then I played Captain Hook in Finding Neverland, and I made all these friends, and I saved their emails and their phone numbers, so I called them and says, please support me. So the place was sold. It was more than sold out. It was a waiting list, and they said, well, gee, we've got to have you back. I don't think they realized that I just had all my friends. Crazy. But anyway, so I've been doing these shows mostly in New England, but then sometimes I go out of state to do out of New England to do other shows. But about 6 weeks ago, 5 or 6 weeks, I developed a pain for the second time in about a month and a half. Right below my sternum, you know, that bone that hangs down, that's right in the center, right above your stomach, right between your ribs. A very sharp pain, and my wife said, "Well, is it bad?" I said, "Yeah, it's really terrible." And this is the second time it's happened, so I couldn't get my breath, and we called 911, took me to the hospital here in the Lakes region of New Hampshire, and they said your pancreas is inflamed, and they took a picture, I did a CAT scan, and thought that I had a gallstone from my gallbladder that got blocked in my pancreas, and they said, and your gallbladder looks terrible, and so they went in, and the stone had gone away. I don't know whether it passed or what happened to it, but so I had to have my gallbladder removed, and you know, I'm in my 70s now, and so I'm to the point where they start taking parts out, you know.
Well, yeah, what's the warranty on a gallbladder? Those things, they don't make it 100,000 miles.
Right. So I feel a little lighter, and then after they sent me home, after about a day, I was gasping for breath about 8 or 9 hours. I went to bed, and in the middle of the night, I couldn't get air and realized that I was kind of wheezing. And again, I called 911 again, and it came back. The ambulance people knew me well, and, oh, John, yeah, Hollywood Squares, and, yeah, because the first time they picked me up in the ambulance, this lady looked at me sideways, and she said, do I know you? And I said, well, you might. I was on television some. And she said, you're John Davidson. I said, well, yes, it says right there on the sheet. You can say, oh, I didn't know you were that John Davidson. She was so cute. And she said, I grew up with you. And I said, well, maybe we could talk about this later. I've got this pain in my stomach, you know. And so we got into the ambulance, and all the way in the way to the hospital, she's putting an IV in my arm. She said, man, you look good for your age. I said, thanks. I don't feel so good right about now, and I don't really feel like talking. She said, oh, that's okay. So she was very nice. She mentioned That's Incredible and Hollywood Squares, and that I sat in for Carson a lot, and it was very flattering, but I was just, you know, trying to get to the hospital.
Right. Not the time for that conversation.
Yeah. So this was, and she was, the second time the ambulance picked me up, it was the same lady. And so she said, I know, you don't feel like talking. So anyway, then I got pneumonia. I couldn't get my breath, and I got pneumonia. That was another week. So I had to cancel like two or three shows, and I felt really bad about that. That was in June and early July. So now I'm getting ready. This Saturday I play a place in Massachusetts. This would be my first show back. I'm trying to think if I'm coming to the Maine area in August. I don't have my schedule in front of me. My schedule is on johndavidson.com.
I didn't see anything up here in August, although we are working behind the scenes to make something happen a little later in the fall. But, yeah, you're at Oak Point in Middleborough, Mass. this weekend.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, good. Thank you for reminding me. How do you know my schedule better than I do, Rich? Anyway, I'm playing Gardner, Maine, in the spring, I guess.
Right, back at Johnson Hall again.
Yeah, Johnson Hall. I think you came to see me there, didn't you?
I sure did. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a small crowd, and I think they didn't realize that they had to promote it by showing pictures of me when I was on television. It's a we can talk about that, but yeah, they invited me back because they love the show, and so now I'm playing that again in the spring. That's kind of the weird thing about my career, Rich. I think you and I talked about this, that even though I was on television so much in the 70s and 80s and 90s, I never had a hit record. And so I played Las Vegas a lot as a singing entertainer. I do a very entertaining, high-energy show, and I still sing well, I think. And I'm really proud of my show. But you have to remind people of, oh, you mean that John Davidson from TV? And sometimes people assume that just because they know of you so well that they and these promoters don't remind people of who I am. So it doesn't always, I don't always have a full house, and it's very interesting. But I love doing my show. I just created a show that I did a pilot for a weekly show called What's Next.
Yes, and I saw that that has been picked up, and that's very exciting news.
Well, it's only on public access television here in the Lakes region in New Hampshire. I hope we will go to other stations, but it's all about what we do with our lives as we approach 60. I mean, Hollywood Squares is off the air, and That's Incredible is gone, and my agent doesn't call as much about doing, you know, whatever. So I've got to think about it's kind of universal. Think of all the people you know who are turning 60, and all the people who we know from television. What do you do when you're not as hot as you were? You know, let's be honest about it. I used to be on television two and three times a week, and then at night hosting at my talk show and everything. But now, even though I still love what I do, I've got to figure out how to. So I'm doing it in a different way. I go out and do these shows with my guitar, and I just love it. And it often goes very well, but I'm dealing with that. So yeah, this is a new show. It's called What's Next, and I'm really did the show to answer a lot of questions for myself. So I hope I can be an inspiration to others.
I think you will be, and also you're doing a really cool thing, and a lot of folks are. We were looking the other day on the Cameo website. There are about 2,000 people out there. Can you talk about what you're doing with Cameo?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for reminding me to talk about that. There is a thing called Cameo, and I don't know how you go to Cameo. I guess you dial into Cameo on the Internet, right?
Yes.
Go to Cameo. And there's a lot of celebrities who are doing this, and I was turned on to this by a friend of mine, Gilbert Gottfried. You know Gilbert Gottfried, who talks like this? Gilbert Gottfried, you know.
And by the way, your appearance on his podcast was fantastic.
Yeah, his podcast was fantastic. Yeah, so I was a guest on his podcast, and he said you would love Cameo. And so what it is that people leave me messages for me to do a selfie, to do about a minute long video, sometimes longer, but where I either sing a song on my guitar or I say happy birthday to somebody, happy anniversary, get well quick. I send messages, and with their name, they'll say to me, you know, my friend Victoria is going through this or that. And so I say, Victoria, I'm John Davidson from television. Remember me? And I just want to say that your friend Sally wants you to get well quick, or to have a wonderful divorce, or whatever you're going through. And so I love doing this. I've done something less than 10. I've only been doing it for a couple of weeks. But so yeah, if anybody wants me to leave a message for their grandma or anybody who would remember my career from television, Broadway, and film, that's what I do. And it costs something. I guess the fee is $50 or something like that. But it's something that I love to do. I do the selfie myself, and all I have to do is to find out how to get to Cameo. I guess you're on the internet. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's Cameo. Cameo.com is the website, and then you just search for John Davidson, and all the info comes right up.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe somebody will ask me to do a cameo that lives in Charleston, Maine. I used to go up to Charleston, you know, just below Bangor. When I was a kid, I went up to visit my
Flossie. Flossie, right?
Oh, how do you know that? Did I tell you that last time?
I do my research.
Yeah, I had a crazy aunt. They said it was something about when she was born, she didn't get enough oxygen or something. So, and she's gone now, so I can talk about her, but... I even took my horse up there for the summer, and several summers. And Charleston is beautiful country up there. But yeah, I love Maine. I especially love Five Islands near Georgetown.
Oh yeah,
because it's a place called Gray Havens Inn that we love to go to. It's a bed and breakfast right on the ocean. I don't get any money for promoting it at all, but my family, my wife and I and our kids have gone there for years, and we love going up to Maine.
John, I was thinking, John Davidson's with us here on Downtown. We were telling the story about the medical people asking you, are you that John Davidson? Now, I don't have that anything near that level of celebrity around here, but I do teach school, and years ago I was in the OR, and they were doing a colonoscopy. And and just as they'd given me the little drug they give you, and just as I'm beginning to zone out and stop being coherent, this young woman, one of the nurses, leaned over and looked at me and said, "Oh, Mr. Kimball, I never thought I'd have you in this position." And it was one of my former students.
That's pretty much the bottom line.
John, you've done so much in your career, stage and at Broadway, films, talk shows, game shows, a sitcom. You've done everything. Of all the things you've done, which is the one where you really, from your perspective, get to show off your skill set and all the many talents that you have?
Oh, you're so nice, Rich. Thank you. I think in each media, you can show off something different. I made two musicals for Walt Disney, two musical films that were right after Mary Poppins. I was the romantic lead in The Happiest Millionaire, and then the romantic lead in The One and Only Genuine Original Family Band, and both of them were opposite Leslie Ann Warren. And it was great making beautiful pictures and singing the musical numbers. The score was by the Sherman Brothers, so Mary Poppins. And it was great working on the Disney lot, but film is, unless you're the director, or unless you have a really phenomenal, I think even if I had a really, no, I had big parts in these films, but still, you can't get anything going. The director yells, cut, that's it, and then they go and shoot it from another angle. I still love live theater, because in theater, once the director sets everything, and once you get the job, each night, trouble is you got to do it 8 shows a week, but theater. I just played The Wizard and Wicked, my favorite role was playing Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha, where you can sing Impossible Dream. You know, Man of La Mancha is just such an incredible role of Don Quixote. In those things, nobody stops you. No one yells cut. And you get to play and really lose yourself in the role. I've done a lot of television acting as well, and rarely was I able to really lose myself in the 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes that a scene takes to shoot it from that one angle. So I like live theater. I've done some recording. I've never had a hit record, but I've made 12 albums, done a lot of recording. And in all honesty, I've never felt as comfortable in a recording studio as I do live. I think the art form of being a singing entertainer, singer, songwriter, storyteller person, it's all about someone receiving what you do. It's an art form that must be received. And if I think there are 3 steps to creating art, the creation, the performance, and then the reception. Someone has to receive it. And so when you're making film or television, you don't feel the reception as much. But when you're performing live, you do feel that. And if some of your listeners, maybe they've made speeches to the Rotary Club, or maybe they've made speeches to their class or to their clubs, or have to get up in front of people and make a speech. The thrill is the reception of it, how it's received, and so I love that feedback as well as making the art. So I like anything that's live. That was a long answer to your question.
Well, no, because it's great, and I, having seen your live show down at Johnson Hall back in the spring, it was great. I mean, your voice is in tremendous shape. The stories are wonderful, but most of all, it's your connection with the audience that makes it such a magical night. And I can't wait to see you again this weekend, August 10th, an evening with John Davidson at Oak Point, Middleboro, Massachusetts. Ahead on the calendar, September 7th at the Chelmsford Center for the Arts in Mass, Birdland in New York City, September 9th, Bennington, Vermont at the Old Castle Theater in September, and Meredith, New Hampshire as well on September 21st. John, glad to hear you're feeling well. Always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Rich. Say hi to everybody in Maine.
That's John Davidson with us here on Downtown. Our thanks to John, also to John O'Hurley and Sarah Parkak. And thanks to you for making us a part of your Sunday here on the Best of Downtown, brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Tomorrow, Carrie, show number 2002. I mean, it's nice. It just doesn't have that zip of 2000.
No, and now I guess we look for when the show catches up to the year. So, you know, we got 2019 coming up. Yeah, that'll be another one.
It won't be long. And, of course, our 8th anniversary coming up in early September as well. The long and short of it is this: we can always find a reason to have a party and to celebrate. So tomorrow we'll celebrate being around for another Monday. On the program, movie reviews from Alan Adams of The Main Edge on Pass the Popcorn. We'll get you caught up on all the weekend sports activities as well. Also coming up next week, we think Wayne Harvey will be on with us to talk about Wayne's Whiffle for a Wish and his new radio gig, if they got cold feet and changed their mind, which would be certainly understandable. Also next week, country music legend Whisperin' Bill Anderson will join us, our regulars as well. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and we'll see you tomorrow afternoon at 4 right here on Downtown.